The Broadcasting Foundation of America presents the International Literary Report, a weekly radio journal featuring profiles of authors, reviews of their latest works, and news of other important literary events from around the world. Today's program originates in the New York studios of the Broadcasting Foundation of America. And here's Margaret Ireland to introduce one of the great names in American theater.
Our distinguished guest, Garson Kanin, is a man who wears many hats. As a playwright, he has won fame with many plays, including Born Yesterday. He was screenwriter for Adam's Rib. He stage directed The Diary of Anne Frank. He became opera librettist and director for the Metz production of Die Fledermaus. As a biographer and short story writer, he's well known in the literary world. And now Mr. Kanin is sporting another hat. He's turned novelist, and he's just written a book called One Hell of an Actor, which is published by Harper and Row. Mr. Kanin, I'm not sure that the book should be called a novel. It's such a mixture of fact and fiction that it reads almost like a biography. Can you tell us something about the man who inspired the book and the title, One Hell of an Actor?
Thank you, Margaret. Well, I agree that there is some question as to whether or not One Hell of an Actor should be called a novel properly. But one of the reasons for that is that Harper and Row and I were rather anxious to stay out of the law courts. We didn't want to be hit with suits for libel and slander by identifying very real people. You remember that marvelous thing they used to have in front of movies and sometimes in front of books? The characters in this work are fictitious and any similarity to real...
Of course.
Well, that was their way of covering themselves legally. And indeed, this story that occupied me for 35 years on and off, as you know, began when I heard about this remarkable man in San Francisco, a theatrical figure, an actor, a director, a producer, a theater owner, who had more or less dominated that great, great era in American theatrical history centered in San Francisco, early in the 19th century, then through the San Francisco earthquake and fire, then the rebuilding of the whole city and its theaters. And he lived to a rather ripe old age and died in 1930. And I heard about him. And his life seemed to me to epitomize that whole bursting, glorious, golden era. And at that time, I was writing films for Spencer Tracy, and it struck me that this might be a character for him to play. You know, of course, Margaret, that all fine works of literature or drama or nowadays film, television, are really based upon character rather than narrative. I don't suppose there are any stories left to tell. All the stories have been told, and nothing ever succeeds on jokes or scenes or violence or excitement. It really has to do with characters, so that when you find an extraordinary character, you know that you have a literary subject.
Well, this man, John J. Tumulty, was certainly an extraordinary man, and some thought him the greatest American actor of his time. And yet we know up until now very little about him. He barnstormed through the West in the early part of the century, didn't he?
Yes, mainly in California, up and down that coast. Because, do remember, we had very little competition for the legitimate theater. There was, of course, no radio, no television, no films, so that people's literary input came basically from the legitimate theater. This time, of which I write in the beginning, there were 45 legitimate theaters lit up every single night in San Francisco, and Tumulty's was one of them, and one of the most distinguished. And then, of course, there was that whole intriguing story of the man who some people thought was his son, some people thought was his illegitimate son, some people thought was his adopted son, others thought he was just a hanger-on. When I came to know the man himself, he was rather ambivalent about his relationship to Tumulty. So the story began to have mystery, and I suppose in some ways it can be considered a detective story of someone trying to find out the truth about someone else.
Now, you protect this man's identity with initials by calling him B.D.
Mm.
And was his existence really the crux of the reason the book became a novel rather than a biography?
I don't know why it became a novel. I think out of desperation, because as I relate, I collected these notes and searched down the clues, and then when I'd give it up, for example, after Spencer's death, I just lost interest in it for a few years. And then that extraordinary thing happened when my wife was playing the matchmaker in Edinburgh, and I went to see a college play, and on the stage walked Tumulty. I just knew it was. I was convinced there could not have been such a likeness if it hadn't been a bloodline. And when I investigated it, eventually I found it was perfectly true that this was indeed a descendant of Tumulty, who didn't know he was a descendant of Tumulty, but I did. So you can imagine how intriguing all that is to try to find out. And then the whole story of the money. Why? Why did B.D. keep giving his father or his adopted father or his illegitimate father, why did he keep giving him all this money, and what the hell did Tumulty do with it? It was proven to me beyond the shadow of a doubt that he had given him all this money, and yet Tumulty was always dead broke. He used to borrow $20 from the doorman from time to time, or if to put on a new production, he'd borrow money from his own company, the people who were working for him. But how do you put those things together? Why was he always broke, and why was he always taking money from B.D.? I must say, I never solved that until the very end, when I learned what happened to the money.
You constructed the book as a series of dated entries in a journal. In fact, it's a 37-year saga, isn't it, from May 1940 to the present year, when you finally laid Tumulty to rest. But going back 37 years, is that the time you actually became interested in exploring the life and times of the actor?
Precisely. It was in 1940. I was then the secretary of the Screen Directors Guild, and part of my duties as an officer was to go out to the Motion Picture Relief Fund home at least once a month to look things over. And so one day when I went over, I met this little old actor, and he was testy and unpleasant and complaining, and to placate him, I took him to lunch. Alexander Wolcott once gave me a marvelous piece of advice. He said, if you ever encounter a really boring person, and you find yourself locked with this boring person on a plane or a train or a ship or at a weekend, always ask that person to tell you the story of their life, and it will never be boring, because everyone's life is interesting. So I said to this little old man, who really was boring, I said to him, how did you happen to go on the stage? And he began, and he told me this fantastic story, which I immediately recognized as raw material.
A lot of real people are part of the book, and that makes it difficult sometimes to separate the fact from fiction. But there are some provocative areas I'd like to ask you about, because some well-known people are involved. You include a letter purportedly written by Edwin Booth to Tumulty, and it's obvious from that letter that he had seen Tumulty act. Does that letter in truth exist?
When I was researching the book, Margaret, I was in San Francisco, and I haunted the old bookshops, the antique bookshops, the autograph collections, and indeed, in Boston at Goodspeed's, I was able to find a lot of those letters, and here in New York, Charles Hamilton let me look at a lot of letters. There was a letter written by Edwin Booth to the man I call Tumulty. But there's a curious matter of letters, as you probably know. If I write you a letter, the letter itself, by that I mean the piece of paper, belongs to you, and it belongs to you in perpetuity. You may give it to your children, and they may give it to their children. They may sell it 10 times over. I don't mean to be so immodest. Probably no one would want to buy it, but I'm saying, suppose I were Edwin Booth or Robert Redford.
Yes.
Well, a letter from me to you or to anyone is a piece of property. And that property remains as part of your possessions and your estate. You may sell it, and then the buyer may sell it, and so on. I cannot claim that letter. I mean, I can't write you and say, give me back my letter, because it belongs to you. However, the contents of the letter, the literariness of the letter, belongs to me. And you may not publish that letter without my permission. So that all of those letters, the Booth letters, yes, I could have bought the letter, but I could not fairly have used the contents in a literary way. So that what I did was to read perhaps 60 or 70 letters written by Edwin Booth, including the letter that he wrote to my Tumulty, and then I created a kind of pastiche. I wrote a letter which was enough like a real Edwin Booth letter so that it would sound like one.
That's a fascinating definition. I can understand that point. Another point you make in the book, Mr. Kanin, you say that Lionel Barrymore gave a speech at Tumulty's funeral. Is this so?
Yes, it is.
Yes. And Ethel Barrymore and Lorette Taylor were supposed to have known him.
Yes.
Is that really so?
Yes. Lorette Taylor's husband, first husband, was a man named Charles Taylor, who was almost a kind of Tumulty in Seattle. He was the Seattle Tumulty, and produced plays and wrote plays and acted in plays with his then-wife, Lorette Taylor. And I think it was in that connection that Lorette Taylor came to know him.
Whether your characters are real or invented, they make a fascinating collection. You reveal so many insights into each person that he or she, for me, became real, whether or not it was so. For example, B.D., the film director, who began as an actor, you say that apparently he was a good performer only when he imitated his father, John J. Tumulty. And I found that to be an interesting reason for B.D. to give up acting. Your book, One Hell of an Actor, has some very compassionate insights. And here's one example I'd like to read. It's very short. You're talking about an old actress. She's a standard type, leading lady grown old. I have the impression that I have seen her before, but this is only because I have seen so many like her. Her hair is light blonde, her eyes deep blue, and from tip to toe there is plenty of leftover beauty. Her outfit is jaunty, and she is made up skillfully, professionally. She must have rested, too, because I was amazed at her youthfulness when we met, and then saw it leave her in 2 hours. When I brought her back to the home, she had scarcely the strength to say goodbye. I suppose that is what age is, mainly, fatigue. I found that very moving.
Yeah, that particular meeting I remember very well. Marvelous old lady, very theatrical, well-spoken, flirtatious and coquettish even, and you could just see that she had gotten herself up, as we say, for this meeting, but in 2 hours it was gone. It was like an old racehorse trying to run the distance and not quite making it toward the end.
But you saw that in such a compassionate way. You see characters from the inside, and that's another reason I found your book so entrancing. Would I be right to say that where fact and fiction mingle, is your detective story hunt for Tumulty's descendants and friends through Britain, France, and here in the United States.
Margaret, let me give you perhaps the best analysis or the best overall view of the difference between fact and fiction. I, as you know, am a disciple of Thornton Wilder's, to whom my book is dedicated. And Thornton Wilder once wrote the following passage. He wrote, "If Queen Elizabeth, or Frederick the Great, or Dr. Johnson, or Ernest Hemingway, were to read their biographies, they would exclaim, 'Ah, my secret is still safe.' But if Natasha Rostova were to read War and Peace, she would cry out as she covered her face with her hands, 'How did he know? How did he know?'" So that when you are really looking for the truth, it's almost incumbent upon a writer to go to the fiction form, because you can never really, truly find out about a real person and prove the facts. But in a fiction, you can make a speculation that may work out. I dare say that no human being, whoever lived, ever knew the whole truth about any other person. I've been married to Ruth Gordon for 35 years. We have a very intimate relationship. We have a good marriage. I certainly don't hold anything back from her, nor does she from me. But after 35 years of continuous marriage, I don't think I know her terribly well. I mean, she's still quite mysterious to me.
We know of your deep friendship and association with Spencer Tracy and the book you wrote, which came out of that, Tracy and Hepburn. You mentioned earlier that you envisioned him as playing the role of Tumulty someday. Now that Tracy's gone, will Tumulty ever be reincarnated by you for the stage or screen?
Well, perhaps not by me, but I think it'll be done. I was in California a few days ago, and there's a good deal of interest in One Hell of an Actor as a film, and various splendid players are being mentioned for it, among them George C. Scott, Gregory Peck, Paul Newman, Bob Redford. There are awfully good actors around these days, as you know, and I don't think a producer would have any great problem in casting the role, because every actor in the world spends his life looking for good parts.
Mr. Kanan, you collaborated with your wonderful wife, Ruth Gordon, on some outstanding scripts. Can you mention one or two of your favorites?
Well, we only wrote four pictures together, and I'll tell you in a minute why we stopped writing together. We first wrote a film called A Double Life, for which Ronald Colman won an Academy Award, and which introduced, for better or worse, Shelley Winters. And then we did a picture for Tracy and Hepburn called Adam's Rib, followed by another picture for Tracy and Hepburn called Patent Mike. And then we wrote a picture for Judy Holliday called The Marrying Kind. And although in our married life we never quarrel, I mean, we never got into the habit of quarreling somehow. I once said to Ruth, "I notice all our friends quarrel, and they seem to enjoy it so much. They seem to have such a good time scrapping. How is it that we don't quarrel?" And Ruth said, "I don't think we've got the time, because it does take a lot of time to quarrel. First, it takes time to whip it up, and then to go the 10 rounds, and then, of course, the making up process is also time-consuming. So we don't quarrel. We never have, and we don't now. We disagree, of course, but we don't quarrel. When we were writing together, we not only quarreled, but I thought we were going to kill each other. It was...
Really?
Oh, it was agonizing. Ruth is a unique person with an individual point of view and certain tastes and certain opinions and feelings about what's funny, about what isn't funny, about what's original, about what's derivative. And I suppose I have my feelings about those things, too. And when we were trying to work together, it was almost disastrous. So, being sensible and realizing that if we didn't achieve a professional divorce, we would soon have to deal with a real one, we stopped writing together, and we have not done anything together in the way of writing for about 25, 26 years now, at least.
Is it that long? Mm-hmm. You've had so many careers wrapped in your one life. Actor, saxophone player, director of films and plays and opera, writer of screenplays, short stories, and books. Is there anything you haven't done that you'd like to do?
Well, I'd like to write a really fine book, yes.
Well, you've already done that several times.
Well,
that doesn't count.
I somehow feel I would like to leave a book behind that will live. For example, if I had written the book that John Cheever has recently written, Falconer, I would be terribly content because I feel that Falconer is certainly a novel that will live as long as there's literature. I think that The Grapes of Wrath is such a book, and I think that Thornton Wilder's The Bridge of San Luis Rey is such a book. Yeah, I think I've written a play. I think Born Yesterday will probably be played as long as there's theater. And I would like to do that in a book as well.
Have you any books in the offing?
Yes, I have finished a new book, a nonfiction book, on a subject which is not only a subject that elicits passion in me, but also anger and fury and desperate excitement, and that is a book called It Takes a Long Time to Become Young, which will be published by Doubleday late this fall. And what it is an attack on the youth cult that seems to have taken hold of our nation in a very destructive way, in my opinion. And I explain how this came about, what keeps it alive, and how we're going to get rid of it, because I am sure that not only are we going to get rid of it, but we have to get rid of it, because we're blowing our brains out.
Coming back to one hell of an actor, I'd like to quote Ring Lardner Jr., who calls it a triumphant blend of fine storytelling, outsized characters, suspense, and a technique that reminds us fiction is still a fluid form. Mr. Kanin, it's been a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you, Margaret. My pleasure.
Garson Kanin has been interviewed by Margaret Ireland at the Broadcasting Foundation of America in New York. Mr. Kanin's earlier books include a biography, Tracy and Hepburn, a novel, A Thousand Summers, and a history of Hollywood. His plays have made him famous, and one of them, Born Yesterday, has become an American classic. As a screenwriter, he's perhaps best known for Adam's Rib. He has directed films in Hollywood, stage productions on Broadway, and opera at the Met. Garson Kanin, one of the great names in American theater. This program is a regular presentation of the Broadcasting Foundation of America. We hope you'll join us next week at the same time for another edition of the International Literary Report.